Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. The 1990s were a time of rapid change. For the United States, the Cold War was over, the Soviet Union had been conquered, and history had ended. For Russia and its people, it was a time of acute hardship, humiliation, and disorientation that took decades to overcome. Fast forward to 2022, and rapid change is back with somewhat reversed roles. Russia is now confident, and the United States is divided. Can the two ever reach a balance of a genuine win-win? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Brussels by Gilbert Doctorov, an international affairs analyst. Mr. Doctorov, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, I know that you were living in this country when the Soviet Union was collapsing and had that amazing opportunity of seeing history develop in front of your own eyes, to the extent that the events of the past year seemed like the past century bygones. I wonder, with such conditioning, a pretty rare conditioning, are you taking this year so far? Do you think the speed and the scale of changes is more or less dramatic than what you saw back in the 1990s?
Well, there is no question, but there is a similarity here in the way a mainspring of a clock is allowed to release itself after having been held locked in position for many years. In the case of the 1990s, the mainspring was locked for 70 years. Here, it has been locked for a briefer period, but nonetheless, we're seeing an energy and change, drama and change, that is a historic. It is more controlled, though, and it is more conscious than what happened in the chaotic 1990s. And in this sense, Russia is knowingly, willingly taking on a role in changing the whole world order around the principle of multipolarity.
Mm-hmm. Now, using this metaphor of the mainspring, one could argue that the more it's controlled, the more it's suppressed, the faster and the more forceful will be the rebound. Using this analogy, where do you think the events are leading now, both in the relations between Russia and the West and more globally?
Well, there are changes at all levels, including changes within Russia and the balance of power within Russia between conservatives and liberals. That has been dramatically changed. The balance between Russia and the West is something we see in the dynamic every day. It has many different vectors. These include the question of the de-dollarization, the question of the deindustrialization of Europe and its fading role in the world compared to Russia's comparative stability and intended growth through a reindustrialization. These are processes that are very much in evidence and use mm-hmm. evidence in the daily news that we read. Mm-hmm. As regards the global balance, Russia has clearly won the interest and attraction of the global South. And there have been dramatic changes in world diplomacy that are swept to the sides of our Western mainstream, but occasionally reemerge and attract some interest. And that, I have in mind the changes in the Middle East, the changes in relationships between the United States and Iran, or Western Europe and Iran, versus Russia's growing strategic alliance with Iran, and Russia's rapprochement and in increasingly important cooperation with Saudi Arabia at the expense of that country's 50-60-year close ties with the United States. These are issues that come into the news. They are issues which tell us that the global order is changing in ways that we will see roll out for decades to come.
Mm-hmm. Now, and I think you would agree with me that the speed of that change is now being expedited by the Russian military operation in Ukraine, and perhaps consciously so. At least the analysts and the decision makers that I sometimes talk to here in Moscow make no secret about that. Russia also makes no secret about the fact that its main grievance in this whole conflagration with the West was the balance of power, the balance of security in Europe, which in the West is usually looked through the lens of Russia's imperial ambitions. I wonder if that's how you see it, Russia's main motive as this insatiable hunger for more territory and more influence over its immediate neighborhood.
Well, the fundamental thing that I see is Russia was and remains a reactive power in its basic posture, and is not an aggressor or looking for an empire. On the contrary, much discussion is taking place in public space in Russia over the value or the cost of the empire that it once held under the name of the Soviet Union. And there is very little appetite in Moscow to go back to those relationships, which from the standpoint of Moscow were very costly. And Russia's international activities at that time were all on the disbursement side and very little on the profit side. Russia's relations with its neighbors has as a core the idea of buffer zones and security for everyone, not conquest and additional territory, which only would come at the cost of political stability within Russia itself.
Now, as a Russian, I can clearly understand why Moscow felt extremely anxious about one of its neighbor after another being courted and then drawn into NATO. But I wonder, what is it on the Western side that makes Washington and its allies see Russia as an adversary, given that until February this year, and I think to some extent, until this point, Russia has been pretty amenable to negotiations and a compromise?
As I said, Russia's position during much of this millennium has been reactive to the aggressive expansionist position of NATO. It has not, until February 24th, taken the initiative to defend actively its own interests. And this is a basis for some criticism of the Kremlin, both within Russia and by many Russia's friends outside of Russia. However, considering the responsibility that the Kremlin has for maintaining world peace and for avoiding a nuclear war, as being one of the two largest owners of nuclear stockpiles in the world, I have to understand the caution, and I understand the vocabulary of the Russian president, Mr. Putin, whose words very repeatedly in speaking about this or that international issue are akkurat, careful, prudent. That has guided Russian behavior till now. It is something that regrettably Western leaders failed to comprehend.
Mm-hmm. Or perhaps took for a weakness. Given your understanding of Putin's rationale, Mr. Doktorov, let me ask you about one thing that puzzles many observers here in Moscow, and it is the fact that the Kremlin has been pretty vague about where and when this military operation will be seen as accomplished, both territorially and in terms of strategic interest. Where do you think Moscow should draw the line, and how big is the threat of overreach, biting more than Moscow can chew?
Well, Russia's primary interest, as I see it, is the security issue that preceded the unleashing of the special military operation. That is to say, additional territory may be desirable. Taking the Black Sea littoral may be an ambition that of the Kremlin, but it doesn't exist by itself. It is only in reference to the state of play between Russia and the West in general, and Russia and whatever government is sitting in Kiev. If that government in Kiev keeps its hands free to procure and receive arms and other support from the West, then Russia's ambition on the ground has to be further reaching. If the conclusion of this war is an acknowledgement all around in the West and in Kiev itself that Ukraine cannot remain a fortress for the United States and NATO at Russia's borders, but will instead be a neutral state, then the territorial ambitions of Russia in the special military operation will necessarily be reduced.
I know that in one of your articles, you mentioned that there is a possibility of not just two, but three Ukraines. How do you see the logic of it?
Well, from the beginning of the special operation to today, the conflict has evolved and changed in nature and intensity, and solutions along the way drop off. The three Ukraines, I don't think is a valid solution in any way for where we are today. However, a rump Ukraine, that is to say, Ukraine stripped of the Black Sea littoral, stripped of the eastern oblasts, which constitute the Donbas and the two other oblasts that have now been incorporated in Russia, as well as additional territory. This is a likely end game. However, as I say, territory per se is not the issue. Security, which would be ensured by the neutral status of Ukraine, by the inability of foreign powers to set up temporary or permanent military establishments on Ukrainian territory, that has to be the overall final objective of the Kremlin.
Mm-hmm. Now, one concern that I have about this possible scenario is that it would make the Ukrainian national destiny somewhat akin to the Kurdish national destiny, which has long been, a headache for countries that host large Kurdish communities. And any division of a people like that is bound to produce an urge to unite that, you know, some powers may choose to capitalize upon. Do you think it's really wise to settle this conflict by sort of potentially sowing the seeds of new ones?
Well, as I said, it depends on the nature of the agreements that are reached, not only between Russia and Ukraine, but with the other interested parties in this proxy war. If there are ironclad guarantees that there will be no assistance to rebuilding a Ukrainian army and to providing equipment to that, then I think Russia could be content and would not face a risk. Mm-hmm. And the resurgence, what you say, the type of revanchism that you were mentioning is likely only if this war continues and takes a malevolent turn in the sense that there's additional massive outflow of refugees from Ukraine. That is possible. It is not necessary, but it is possible, depending on how this destruction of the energy infrastructure proceeds and whether or not, with or without the permission and encouragement of Zelensky and his regime, the Ukrainian people flee their cities and head for the West. If you see an outflow of another 10 million Ukrainians across the border into the EU, then the scenario that you just described of a nation diaspora and seeking to reconstitute itself, it could be a realistic situation.
Well, but in this case, it would also be the EU that will have to be dealing with it, not just Russia. Mr. Doctorov, we have to take a short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
За военных, которые погибают, но они достойны защищать нашу родину.
По нам начали стрелять украинские. Мне ногу ранили. Вот так вот аж. Да чуть-чуть остался шрам.
Фашисты первые наступали на нашу землю, а мы защищали ее, терпели, погибали. Но они все равно идут прямо до победы.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Gilbert Doctorow, an international affairs analyst. Mr. Doctorow, before the break, we discussed how existential and strategic this issue for Russia, but you also mentioned that NATO's credibility has been put on the line, and that was even before this latest incident with the remnants of a rocket falling onto the Polish territory and killing two Polish civilians, something that the Ukrainians jumped upon to reinforce that narrative that Russia is out to conquer and rape the free world. But NATO's response for now has been fairly subdued, if not timid. How would you explain that?
Well, the response of NATO was given by the people who run NATO, and they're sitting in Washington, not in Brussels. When we heard a couple of hours after the missile strike in Poland, when we heard President Biden respond to reporters' questions in Bali, what this was all about, and he said that from the trajectory information of reconnaissance by United States planes in that area, it was clear that this missile did not come from the Russian side. When he did that, he pulled the rug out from under not only Mr. Zelensky, but also from those NATO countries, particularly the Baltic states, which had jumped in as the jackals that they are to repeat and insist that Russia was to blame and that the Article 4 and possibly Article 5 of the Alliance Treaty should be invoked, bringing us very close to World War III. What we saw in this event was something extraordinary, because similar incidents have occurred in the last 5 years or more. Going back to the MH17 case, these false flag operations, in Syria, the allegations that the Syrian regime had used chemical weapons against its civilians. These incidents were, within minutes of their occurrence, denounced from Washington and Brussels as showing the malevolent and criminal nature of respective regimes in Moscow or in Damascus. This did not happen. It's the first time that an event like this has occurred where the United States put a stop to it, pulled the plug on it. Mm-hmm. It is looking backwards, it's a very good evidence that those previous events, like MH17, which was receiving its verdict today here in Europe, that these events were stage managed from Washington and London. That's looking back. Looking present and forward, it tells you that the United States is looking with alarm at Mr. Zelensky, and although they make public statements through Mr. Stoltenberg or in Washington that yes, the Russians are to blame ultimately for this happening because of the war they're waging, the behind the scenes we made sure that there are very rancorous words being had with Mr. Zelensky for trying to pull NATO into a war with Russia.
Well, absolutely, because NATO doesn't want to sacrifice or risk the lives of its own soldiers. It would rather prefer to fight this war through the lives of the Ukrainians. Now, I agree with you totally that this is quite an extraordinary event. And I was particularly surprised by one of the articles in the Financial Times, which expressed or rather cited an anonymous diplomat from a NATO country in Kyiv that directly accused Zelensky of lying and saying that it was more disconcerting than even the missiles. So essentially telling the Ukrainian leadership that it's not okay to provoke NATO in such a way. Do you think we've ever reach a point when both sides will be so irritated with each other that they will hate each other more than they hate their common enemy, which is Russia?
Yeah, so I think the love affair with Mr. Zelensky is fading in front of our eyes, and is fading in due to fear. I think that no one rationally would welcome the realization, implementation of Article 5. No one rationally wants to go into a war with Russia, which has its logical outcome, a nuclear exchange and the end of life on Earth. The United States in particular, Washington in particular, as you say, has been very brave with Ukrainian soldiers, but is a bit more realistic, or if you want to be unkind, cowardly, when it comes to a direct conflict with Russia. Mm-hmm. I do hope that the Kremlin takes note of that cowardice, because it should be used going forward in dealings between the two parties. Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking about the Kremlin's own analysis, you've been pretty resolute about the U.S. and NATO roles in this conflict, but you also laid the blame with Vladimir Putin's intelligence advisors and him personally for what you call a miscalculation of colossal proportions at the beginning of this operation. What did they get wrong, in your view?
Well, I think there was, and it's very quite surprising that there was this erroneous intelligence information coming to the Kremlin and guiding the conduct of the first few weeks of the war until it became manifestly clear that this would not do. What was wrong was the notion which came out of the experience in 2014, in March of that year, in the proceedings on Crimea, where a force of 18,000 Russian soldiers on the peninsula, matching approximately the same 18,000 Ukrainian army forces on the peninsula, ended in the surrender, the raising of the white flag by the Ukrainians, by many of those Ukrainians abandoning ship literally and figuratively and joining the Russian army and joining Russia, while others were allowed freely to go home when they gave up their weapons. That experience set in motion a vision of Ukraine as being very poorly organized, as having very low patriotic levels. And that certainly had to influence the way that Russia entered the special military operation, expecting to be met by flowers as their tanks approached Kiev. It didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Nothing of the sort happened. It ignored the 8 years of indoctrination and of very heavy investment in equipment and training that NATO has done over that period, and also the work of vicious propaganda and street bullies across Ukraine who have enforced a patriotism based on relation to Russia that stuck. And so the challenge that Russia faced entering into this was of a different nature mm-hmm. than clearly what was expected when it began.
You know, I've spoken to a couple of Russian and Donbas military commanders recently, and I think some of those lessons have been learned. I think over the last couple of months, what at least I am seeing in Russia is both the humbling of public rhetoric and the tightening of the military operation with far more focus on tactical issues, on the preservation of resources, both people and weapons, and the overall focus on the actual combat rather than any chest-pumping propaganda. And it's almost as if the Russians have given up on winning the informational war, and instead they are focusing exclusively on the conventional war. Do you think that's a sort of a wise choice of priorities in this case?
Well, there's an old expression in English folk wisdom that sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can't harm me. And the information war is a war of words. The Russians do not have the experience, do not have the money invested in information wars that the United States and the UK in particular have. And this is not a domain that has material consequence. What happens on the ground in conventional warfare does have consequences. And at the same time, I point out that within Russia, there also has been an information war. And it is a war which has had consequences and has helped determine what the public mood in Russia is today, as far as I understand. The We talked about the exodus of young men from Russia to places like Kyrgyzstan to avoid participating in the war. But there's been a very big exodus within Russian administrative ranks of those who were, say, sitting on two chairs, of those who were closet or even open liberals in over the last 20 years, and were applying brakes, were slowing down the development of a genuinely sovereign Russia. Those people have left the ranks, not entirely, but largely, and Russia's mood is decided, governed more by people who were in the recent past would have been called conservatives. And it's this conservative patriotism that I see when I visit Russia, and it is quite a change. And the public announcements about the war have also changed since the middle of September, since the terrorist acts. The public information that I see when I watch Russian television is far more transparent and, I'd say, far more honest with the public about the true state of the military affairs. And that's very good, because with the call up of reserves, this has become a national war, not a war of the contract soldiers.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. And I think at this point of time, we are even seeing the whole notion of conservatism being reinterpreted as something that is encourages people to stay in touch with reality and invest with their whole lives in what is happening about, rather than pontificating about some abstract ideas. And I'm reminded here about this old American expression, perception is reality, which in fact was introduced by one of the Republican spin doctors, Lee Atwater, who served as an advisor to Ronald Reagan and helped him win those elections. And I think ever since, the American public life and the American policy to a large extent is based on that mantra. And Ukrainians are very eager to sort of reinforce it, that perception is reality. That's why they're investing so much in the propaganda effort and various false narratives. But I think a decision has been made in the Kremlin and by Putin personally, when he called the United States the empire of lies, that he wants to introduce a new sort of a new attitude towards reality and the respect for reality as it is. It's an ontological and philosophical question, but do you think Russia has enough resources, not only financial, but I would say intellectual or spiritual resources to, you know, prove that point and to reintroduce reality as it is and realism as a way of doing politics in the world?
Well, going to realism is all to the good. You spoke about perceptions. That is a bit dated, because you took it back to Ronald Reagan. We're living in the age of virtual reality, and that is even farther removed from what is under your feet. So the United States is suffering from that infatuation with virtual reality and from being cut off from the reality around us.
From life.
We are creating. And whereas what Russia is moving precisely that direction, towards realism and full appreciation of the challenges that you face and not covering them up.
And I hope the rest of the world also finds some virtue in that. Mr. Doctorov, we have to leave it there, but it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much for this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.